Hi everyone, Andrew here. Thanks for listening. You'll get a proper hello and welcome in just a moment. But I'm breaking in quickly to tell you about two things that have come up since this episode was recorded about 2 weeks ago. So please bear with me just a second, and I promise it'll be worthwhile. This is a really good show we have coming up. Brad Willis is the guest, and if you don't know who he is, you can just take my word for it that this is an interview worthy of episode 150. The first thing I want to tell you, and I realize a lot of you probably know this already, is that I won a good-sized tournament at Lucky Chances Casino here in the Bay Area. Nate and I are going to talk about that on the air, but I had not yet won at the time that we recorded this episode, so we'll be talking about that on episode 151, but I imagine some people will wonder why they didn't hear about it on this episode, and that's the reason why. There's also a pretty thorough write-up on my blog right now. That's at www.thinkingpoker.net. You may have to scroll down through a couple of posts depending on when you're listening to this, or you can search Battle of the Bay, which is the name of the tournament, if you want to read the write-up for that event. The second thing is an opportunity for you to get some really high quality strategy content from myself and from some other great players, including some former guests on this show, at a great price, maybe even with some free coaching, and to give to a great cause at the same time. You may remember, I told you a few weeks ago about the Bay Area Urban Debate League, which is a great nonprofit organization that I'm affiliated with here in the Bay Area. It's an organization that provides academic debate, which is kind of like organized, intelligent arguing, in a variety of formats to young people, primarily low-income young people, in San Francisco, Oakland, and other communities in the Bay Area. Debate did a lot to change my life. It helped to make me a smarter and a better person, and I've seen lots of first and secondhand examples of what a life-changing opportunity it can be for young people from schools and neighborhoods where there just aren't a lot of opportunities to do genuinely intellectually engaging things. The Bay Area Urban Debate League provides some really high-quality programs that help ensure that these bright, talented kids are not slipping through the cracks. Why am I telling you this? I am excited to announce a big fundraising push that I'm going to be making between now and the end of the year to help raise money for this organization. And a big part of that campaign is going to involve releasing a bunch of strategy content that I think you all will get a lot out of. I've got a campaign set up on a site called Crowdrise, and for every $500 that we raise there, I'm going to put out an hour of video content. And this is going to be something like a hand history review with myself and a guest. I don't want to name any names just yet, but I have some good people in mind, I think. So it'll be the two of us reviewing a hand history together. This will be a video that you'll be able to watch, that anyone will be able to watch for free. So you can imagine this is a little like a Kickstarter campaign. For every $500 raised, there's going to be a new hour of strategy content. That's every $500 raised during the month of December. You can think of this as a little like a strategy-a-thon, right? You keep donating, I'll keep putting out free videos. I'll have some drawings for prizes as well, so anyone who donates at least $10 will be eligible to win a prize, and the prizes are going to include stuff like free month membership at Tournament Poker Edge, a free hand history review for me, a hand of yours discussed on the air as part of the Thinking Poker podcast, and some other goodies as well. If you have already donated, first off, thank you very much. I will certainly include you in the drawings. Don't worry about that. If you have not yet donated, there's a link on my blog and in the show notes, which will be at thinkingpoker.net, or you can go to crowdraise.com and search my name, which is Andrew Brokos, B-R-O-K-O-S, and make your donation there. That'll ensure that it's counted towards this campaign and towards getting more free strategy material out there. You can give any amount that you like, and if you give at least $10, you'll be entered in the drawing for the door prizes that I mentioned. But no matter how much you give, or even if you just think about it, I'm very grateful to you. Now, I saved the best news for last, which is that the Bay Area Urban Debate League right now has a funder who is going to match one-for-one any donations made to this campaign. And that means that every dollar that you give will generate $2 for the league. This is a great cause. It's an opportunity for you to make a really high-impact donation, and it's a chance for you to unlock some free strategy videos and maybe even some free coaching. Again, you can find a donation link at thinkingpoker.net or by searching my name on crowdrise.com. And if you have any questions about this or about the organization, I am reasonably familiar with them. I'm personally vouching for them. I can tell you that your money will be used well, and if you have any specific questions, I'll be happy to address those. Okay, thank you for your patience, and on with the show.
Danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 150 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California, is Andrew Brokus. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well. How are you?
Life is good. Life is good.
I actually have a live sweat. I don't know. We might even get results while we're recording in the WRGPT, the play-by-email tournament that we've hopefully encouraged some of you to play. In fact, I think I have a listener at my table, PDX Heater. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it does. I'd say it's even money or better that he's a listener.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. So my tournament had not gotten off to a great start. You start with 30,000 in chips, and today is day 22. So I had not won a pot, and I just kept, you know, I would like open with king queen, and somebody would make a massive re-raise. Or I'd call with pocket twos, and somebody would make a massive re-raise. I'd flop a flush draw, and somebody would like make a huge bet on the flop. And I kept having to kind of like fold these hands, I want to play. it's a free poker tournament, and I want to play hands, and I kept not getting a chance to play hands. But I was reassuring myself, like, well, if people are really just like, you know, playing this aggressively, all you have to do is make a big hand, and eventually they're going to pay you off. So sure enough, I finally got to see a flop with pocket eights, and it was an 8-3-4 flop with two clubs, and four of us saw the flop, and somebody bet full pot into me, and I called. And I just woke up this morning to find that same person bet full pot on the turn, leaving himself only about half of his, he bet about half of his stack, which was the full pot on the turn. And the turn was a 10 of hearts, so very safe board for me. And I jammed. I'm awaiting resolution, so who knows, I might get an email in the next half hour or so informing me whether or not I've won this pot. But I'm excited.
Yeah, very good. I'm slightly overstarting stack and have not played any hands that are that exciting. I did manage to make a flush once, but didn't get too much action on it. It's a good way to stay sharp, right? The WRGPT.
I don't know if I would say stay sharp. it's fun. I don't know that I consider it, you know, particularly much practice, meaningful practice.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to think about what your ranges should be, you have plenty of time to do that, right?
That is true.
And a wide variety of erratic opponents and some very good opponents are there.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, it looks like there's still, I didn't even realize this, or I guess this shows how little attention I was paying. One other person is still in the pot. He called the flop bet, and I still feel okay about my jam on the turn rather than just calling and leaving a quarter of the pot left in my stack. But there is actually even a third player in the pot who could potentially wake up and call my shove.
Yeah, yeah. When you have like 24 hours to make your move, it's sometimes useful to count how many players are in the pot before you.
Yeah. I was trying to send it off quickly before we started recording.
It's very kind of you, very considerate. Everything else good out there in San Francisco?
Yeah, it is. I actually I went to a different casino out here on Friday night. I've been going exclusively to Lucky Chances, which is the closest place to San Francisco. But there's a casino a bit north of the city called, I'm not sure if it's pronounced Graydon or Grattan, but they run a shuttle from the city up to Graydon, and I was like, oh, I'll check it out. I mean, the games at Lucky Chances have been slightly less good lately than they were. I mean, I didn't really think it was going to be overall a better choice than going to Lucky Chances, but I kind of wanted to just go up there to check it out in case I was missing out on something really good. And they have a 10-25 game on Friday nights, and they also have, they don't generally have 5-10 there, so they've got the 10-25 that goes on Friday nights, and then they have 2-5, but it's a deep stack 2-5, so you can buy in for 1,000, unlike the 500 at Lucky Chances, and you can match the biggest stack on the table. So I kind of thought, well, it'll be fun, it'll be interesting, hopefully I'll play 10-25, and even if, you know, that game doesn't go, or I can't get into it or whatever, like a deep stack 2-5 might not be that worse than a bad 5-10 anyway. Not that the 5-10 at Lucky Chances was guaranteed to be bad, but this is how I justified it to myself. So the shuttle took forever. It was like, it took almost 3 hours for me to get from the city up there. It should have been a little over an hour. A lot of that was due to traffic, which is not unpredictable. I mean, you have to like go over the Golden Gate Bridge, so there's usually a lot of traffic. So it took like a really long time to get up there. And then I was locked out of the 1025. Apparently you had to like, I don't even know if it's the sort of thing that anyone could just call and get a seat in. But in any event, you know, people had like called and locked up seats and whatnot. It wasn't like you could just show up and sit down at the game. So maybe that was a fishy move for me to even think that I was going to be able to just show up and play that. But it looked like a good game, but there was no chance of my getting a seat in it. And despite the fact that you could buy in for 1,000 at the 2-5, a lot of people were just buying in for 200, and it was pretty boring. And then when I was coming back, the shuttle actually broke down. I think it was just overheating, and the guy had to sort of like putter his way into a gas station and fill the radiator. But it was a comedy of misadventure, and I am not eager to go back. And I apologize to the floor people at Lucky Chances who are listening. This is what I get for cheating on you.
Anytime you're taking like group transportation to a casino, I find a lot can go wrong in that situation.
It was basically just me and a bunch of old Chinese people.
Was smoking a lot on the bus?
No, but I'm sure that I think I'm fortunate that it was not.
Yeah, it's.
I think there would have been a lot of smoking.
I remember seeing some of those buses that used to pull into Foxwoods. There were some very, very smoky buses that come in there.
Well, this is our 150th episode, so congratulations to us for making it this far.
Yeah, it's been a good 3 years.
We were kind of thinking of celebrating that by having Brian Koppelman, who ended up being our guest on episode 149, which is the reasons for that are explained on episode 149. Definitely encourage you to go back and listen to that if you skipped it for any reason. I think that was a real high-quality interview. And I'm excited about today's interview as well, though. I think this has the potential to be a big one. We actually haven't recorded the interview yet. For once, we're actually doing our introduction before the interview starts. But our guest is to be Brad Willis, who is just a fantastic writer and a very thoughtful guy. The most recent piece that he wrote is called Bust, and that's been it's about the underground poker scene in South Carolina, and in particular a raid when the police raided the game that went badly and people ended up getting shot, and just kind of looks more generally about the dynamic of underground poker and how that's caused by states prohibiting legal poker games and the consequences that's had. But I think it's very well written, and I'm a big fan of everything he's written. I've never talked to him before, but I can't imagine he's not going to be an interesting guy to talk to.
Yeah, he'll always be Brad Otis Willis to me, and I'll never call him anything else, I don't think. But yeah, I've been reading his stuff for a long time. He's been a thoughtful member of the poker community for a long time. I'm looking forward to talking to him.
Tournament Poker Edge is your source for tournament poker strategy. As a member, you'll get full access to their entire collection of years' worth of videos. That's hundreds of hours of footage from dozens of instructors. Tournament Poker Edge runs the gamut from micro stakes to 5Ks, from theory to hand history reviews, from beginner to advanced material. You can sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com today and start taking your game to the next level. Our strategy hand is coming to us from Ed, and this is a hand from the main event of the World Series of Poker. So it is day three. Stacks are 1,000, 2,000 with a 200 ante. The under-the-gun player opens to 4,000, and he's got a stack of 130K. Ed describes his opponent in great detail, and I think it's important. So this is going to be a somewhat long email, but I think that Ed make some very important observations. So sometimes I skip through some stuff that people include that I don't think is that relevant, but I think Ed has some very insightful things that he picked up about his opponent. Ed says, "The villain came to the table an hour ago with a huge stack, about 350K, has played a lot of hands, I would guess 35 to 40% VPIP, and has been very aggro, but has lost more than half his stack, primarily bluff catching a couple of big pots and being shown the goods. When someone at the table commented on his losses, he snapped back, quote, 'If you can't take swings in your chip stack, you can't be a good player.' The words were meant to show that he understood the swings in poker, but the tone unmistakably showed that he was on tilt. I had been mostly quiet for the time he was at the table, winning a few small pots, reshoving once to take down a pot, but I have not played a hand past the flop since he arrived. I'm a middle-aged guy dressed neatly, and I think my image is clearly as a recreational/amateur player. So we've got that villain opening to 4K, action folds to the hero who has only 43K, or 22 big blinds, in the big blind, and he has two black aces, so this seems like a good time to pause and talk about things so far.
Yeah, great email, great way to interpret the villain's table talk.
I've seen so many players like this. I know exactly what he's talking about, and it is hilarious.
Yeah, anybody who's going out of his way to indirectly say that he's a good player is probably on tilt. So, I mean, there are some people who say that habitually, but those people are also habitually on tilt, I think. So I think that was well interpreted, and I also think the number of people who can lose two-thirds of a 12x stack in the main event and not get a little bit tilted is very small. Even people who play high buy-in tournaments all the time, you know, they only get to play the main event once a year, and it's very hard not to let that affect you. Some people like that are out there, but very few. I do think this person is tilted.
Yeah.
And I think this is all well observed. I also think that somebody dressed neatly in the main event is likely to come off looking like James Bond fashion-wise. So the effect of that is probably exaggerated. I think this is a non-trivial spot with the aces. On the one hand, if villain is tilting a little bit, he might call a 3-bet a little bit too loose. On the other hand, if you just call, you have a nice SPR for trying to get the rest of villain stack on a lot of flops. I think it's a question about which way you're going to get more action. And my first instinct is the 3-bet, but I could be convinced that a call is right. What do you think?
What size would your 3-bet be? Villain opens for 4K. You have 43K in your stack.
10,300.
Yeah, I think you do have to go. I think that's the right neighborhood. Even then, I mean, if we think back to this description of our hero, a middle-aged player, neatly dressed, been very quiet, barely played a pot. You open under the gun. He 3-bets to 10K from the big blind. I mean, I feel like you're just going to correctly read him for a huge hand, right?
Yeah, that's right. But that's what I would choose with a less premium hand. And I think it's heavily dependent on the stack size. Again, hero has 43K before the hand starts. So that's a lot of our stack going in before the flop. Shoving would not be out of the question, I don't think. It's going to be tricky. I mean, if you raise to 15K, that's over a third of your stack.
I'm not arguing for a bigger raise. I think that's part of the issue is there's really not room to, I just think anything you do here other than calling is gonna give off way too much strength. And I think, you know, part of the issue is that you ideally wouldn't have such a nitty image to begin with. There are probably, the hero probably has missed some profitable spots at earlier points, you know, where he could have gotten involved in a pot and didn't. But, that's neither here nor there. I think at this point, we have a situation that has the potential to be exploited, which is that this, you know, player under the gun is tilted and probably opening way too wide and, is going to correctly put the hero, I think, on a very big hand if the hero makes any kind of 3-bet. I mean, obviously a shove just has to be strong because it risks so much and anything, but I think even like a smaller 3-bet, this just doesn't seem to me like a player who's going to have a 3-bet fold range in this kind of spot.
That seems right. In defense of Ed, how many spots could he possibly have missed in the 23 hands since villain came to the table? You know, I think that this image is mostly like a demographic image that he's attributing to himself.
That's fair. So Ed says, I thought my stack was too big for me to have a reshove range, but a 3-bet would look very strong. Most players would have a strong range under the gun, but he was very loose and he seemed to be targeting players. So my recreational image and 22 big blind stack was perfect for him to open wide. Also, my aces blocked a lot of his better hands, so I expected he would be weaker than normal and more likely to fold to aggression than a typical under-the-gun raiser. I decided to flat, and we saw the flop with 10.8K in the pot. I think his reasoning here is spot on.
Yep.
Part of it is because we're in the big blind, there aren't that many hands where 3-bet folding is going to be better than calling. You know, the fact that we have the opportunity to just call for 2K into a pot of, you know, 7K or whatever it is, like we can call getting 3.5 or 4-1, and that's often going to be a more appealing option than 3-bet folding with quite a few hands. I think that's part of the complication of 3-betting here, or why it's difficult to not look very strong when you 3-bet here, is that you really don't need to play weak hands as a 3-bet very often.
Yep.
So part of the reason I want to applaud this is that I think this is, I mean, there is a risk that you're taking when you still play a big hand like this. Like the less risky thing to do certainly is to just 3-bet or shove and take down the pot. And the pot now is not trivial. You know, it probably represents already more than 10% of the hero stack. So I can imagine a lot of people, especially amateur players on day 3 of the main event, who are sort of afraid to do anything risky. And they're just like, I just want the pot that's in there now. And if he calls me, great. And if he doesn't, I'll just take the 4K. So I really want to applaud Ed for not being that player, you know, for actually trying to find the most profitable line here rather than getting nervous, which, I mean, it's happened to me before too, when you're deep in the main event or you're getting deep day 3 and you don't want to bust, I hear it. The flop ends up coming ace-8-3 with 3 hearts. So careful what you risk for. On the one hand, flop top set. On the other hand, there's 3 hearts on the board. And it's going to be a little tricky, I think, to put money in good, so certainly a lot of money in good. It's just it's a tricky place to proceed. First question is, would you consider donking here, or are you going to check to the preflop raiser?
I think I would check my whole range here. I think I'll have hands I want to check raise. I think this board goes some way to catching up a big blind player against under the gun raiser. In particular, the big blind player should have many more flushes than the under the gun player should, but I also think this board hits the under the gun player hard enough that the usual sort of check to the raiser dynamic is good. I think stacks will be fine for check raise shoving. I think you know, choosing some hands to check shove with for value, some semi bluffs to check shove with, and then maybe have a check call. Then also having a check calling range is the right way to go. Not sure I'd want to split anything by betting out here. It's not entirely clear cut, but I like a check. What do you think?
I'm certainly checking this hand. In terms of whether there would be any donking range, I can imagine wanting to donk like pocket eights or pocket threes. You know, I think blocking the ace here really reduces the value of donk betting a lot. When you have eights or threes, you maybe don't want your opponent checking behind. I mean, an ace might not be that likely to check behind anyway, but an ace with a hard kicker, I think, should check behind. And I think there's some question for the villain as to whether or not he should bet a hand like the king or queen of hearts if he doesn't have a pair to go with it. There is a non-trivial amount of showdown value that just like king high is going to have here, and getting check raised when you just have if he has a hand like king 10 with a heart, and you know, getting check raised with a hand like that is not real appealing. So I think that there are some hands that the hero would really prefer the villain not check behind that the villain will check behind.
Yeah.
But I also think that the villain we're expecting from the get-go that he has a very wide under the gun opening range.
Yeah.
Which means he's going to have a lot of hands that are just complete, you know, he's going to have a lot of like 10-9 suited, 10-7 suited kind of hands. Some of those are going to be flushes where, you know, we're probably going to lose our ass if that's what he has, but we're obviously not benefiting by donking into those, but we're also not benefiting by donking into like 10-9 of spades or 10-9 of clubs. And I think Villain is going to want to bluff. I just think he's going to bluff way too much when check due here, basically.
Yeah.
Especially with us holding two aces. I don't see much value in donking with this exact hand.
Yeah, I agree. And if you wanted to make a donking range with something like small flushes, some semi-bluffs like 9-8 with one heart or something like that, I don't know if we're calling that to an under-the-gun raise, but
not folding it.
Yeah. For 2K. Yeah, so pocket 8s, pocket 3s, small flushes, some semi-bluffs. Would that make sense?
I think so. I don't know that. I think 9-8 with a heart is probably going to play better as a check call.
Okay.
I think 9-8 without a heart, I might be more inclined to dunk, or something like 10-9 with one heart, where it's not really good enough to check call, but it may have a decent amount of equity against his betting range, where I don't really want to check fold it either. I think I'd be more inclined to have that kind of semi-bluff.
Yeah, that makes sense. That said, there are a lot of hands like that, right?
Yeah, there are. And it's easy to overdo it. I mean, the 10-9 was not completely arbitrarily chosen.
Sure,
the fact that it also has a backdoor straight draw and two overcards to the 8, like, it's a better dunking hand than 7-6 with one heart is, and the fact that the heart is bigger.
Yeah. Still, even if you take hands with a 3 straight and one heart,
yes,
that's there should be plenty of those.
Yeah. So yeah, you're not going to be able to do all of them, but those are the kinds of hands I would think about dunking, and I think that top set. I mean, top set is not. It's often a good slip line candidate anyway, and I mean the 3 hearts on the board make that a little less appealing here. And I would be check raising if he bets, but I do want to give him a chance to bet in large part because I think he's going to bluff way too much, and this is a hand that does benefit from his bluffs, unlike say 10-9 with one heart, which does not really benefit from his bluffs.
I agree.
And Ed agrees. Ed says, I thought my hand was clearly strong enough to get in on this flop. Since he was aggressive, I checked, planning to check raise. Usually this is a raiser's flop and dunking would be a poor choice, but since I have 2 aces in my hand, in retrospect, I wonder if he checks back too often for a check raise, so maybe I should consider betting here. We were short enough, however, that I didn't need 3 streets to get all the chips in, so I was okay if the flop checked through. The villain did indeed check behind after a moment or two. I thought he would probably bet his air and his weaker pairs with no heart, so when he checked, I thought he might well have a hand with a big heart and didn't want to get blown off of his equity if I check shoved. I think he would bet a set or 2 pair as well, but he was certainly capable of checking sets here. And I think that's mostly good analysis as well. The one thing I would say, when he said the 2 aces suggest that he's going to check back too often, and I don't, I actually don't think that's particularly true. I think that the more important thing, which Ed also identifies, is that the villain is going to bluff here really, really often. So, I mean, to some extent, blocking the aces is actually good in terms of blocking some of the check back range. I think that if the villain had a hand like an ace with a bad kicker, ace 5 of clubs, that's a hand that might consider checking behind. Yeah. And I also think ace X, where X is a heart, might well consider checking behind. So I think that blocking the aces might actually make it less likely that he checks behind rather than more. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think everything that Ed said here is very good.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just to emphasize the point, if you put 7-6 of clubs in villain's hand and then check to him on the flop, I'm not saying it's certain, but I would bet any amount of money at even money that he's betting that hand. Like, he's just not. I mean, he's lost. He's probably on tilt. If maybe he's not on tilt, you know, people are going to bet a lot in that spot. Like, he's just not going to take a shot at the pot against a player of this description. So,
The turn is the 6 of hearts. So the board now, ace, 8, 3, 6, all hearts. And our hero holds black aces. Still 10.8K in the pot. Any merit to betting now?
It has some conceivable advantages, but not many. I don't see a reason to bet.
Yeah, it's not even close to me. I think you have to check. I mean, it is sort of a gross spot. It's not the turn card you wanted to see, but, you know, betting doesn't do anything to change that, I don't think. I don't think you're going to get villain to fold many, if any, hearts. No. You're not really going to get called by worse. I mean, there's no draw that he can have. So at this point, you would love to see a free river card and try to boat up. I think you can check call and try to boat up that way. I don't know actually that you're going to pick off very many bluffs by check calling, just because I think he's doing so much bluffing on the flop that I don't know that he has that many hands that want to bluff on the turn. But I suppose he could have some hands that, you know, he checked on the flop that didn't, I mean, like 8-7 without a heart, maybe if he checks the flop with that, and then he might try to turn that into a bluff on the turn. I don't really see him bluffing that much on the turn, just because I think so many of his bluffs go into his flop betting range.
Yeah.
But I don't think betting really accomplishes much either, so I think we kind of just have to treat our hand as a full house draw, more so than and just recognize it has a little bit of bluff catcher value, but mostly it's just a full house draw at this point.
Yep, I agree. It also has some value bet catcher value, like he might have ace king with no heart and check it on the flop and bet it on the turn. Not saying that would be good, but it's possible. Unlikely, but you know, 8-6 of clubs, a hand like that. But
Ed says, I checked. I really didn't know what to do in this spot. If I lead, he could shove a balanced range and I'm in a gross spot, so I decided to check and see if I could get a read on him. I was leaning toward a small raise if he bet, planning to shove most rivers if he called, and side call it off if he shoved. Once again, he checked behind after a moment or two. At the time, I was at a loss to figure out his range, and time hasn't given me much clarity. What would he play this way, especially at my stack size, when he can put a lot of pressure on me with a small bet?
Yeah, I think check raising would not be great for precisely the reason that Andrew said. Like, you could get him to fold some hearts, maybe. Like, it would have some bluff value. But for the most part, his betting range, because his flop betting range is so bluff heavy, his turn betting range should have a lot of flushes in it, and he's probably not going to want to bet fold a lot of those. So I think check calling is the play here. I think check raising would be a mistake.
Yeah, I think villain doesn't have a lot of incentive to bet small flushes now. If the villain has something like the seven of hearts in his hand, I don't think there's a lot of reason for him to bet the turn with it. He's not going to be able to bet two straights. Even betting one street, I don't know that he's going to be ahead of your check call range if he just has the seven of hearts, certainly on the turn. On the river, he might consider value betting it, but I really don't think you're going to see low flushes betting. I mean, I don't think the turn is going to get bet very often. I think that he's mostly going to have a very strong hand when he bets the turn, and I don't think he's going to bet the turn that much. I'm actually not that surprised to see him check behind here. I think the flop check does a lot more to define his range, and that's the point where I would say, hey, he could have put a lot of pressure on me here, and he chose not to. What does that tell me? It tells me he doesn't feel like he needs to put pressure on me. Like, he thinks that he has a hand that's capable of winning without bluffing. That's what his flop check tells me. The turn check, we already have that information that he thinks he can win without bluffing. So the fact that he's checking the turn, I think, kind of just says he doesn't have the nuts. Like, I think if he has the king of hearts, he would probably want to start building a pot, or maybe even the queen of hearts. But I think with lower hearts, where he's not going to be able to value bet twice, he really has no reason to think that hero is even drawing live against him. If he's holding something like the seven of hearts, there's a pretty good chance that the hero is just drawing dead. He doesn't know that we have top set and would really like to see a free river. As far as he's concerned, seven of hearts is like, it's pretty safe for him to just check behind on the turn, because there are not very many rivers that are going to take a hand that he was beating and put that hand ahead of him. So I wouldn't expect small hearts to bet very much here. And in fact, I would think that there's a very good chance he either has a good pair, like a pair of aces with no heart, or he has a low flush. That's what I would expect from the check back.
Yep.
We go to the river, and the river is the case ace. So finally something goes Hero's way. Hero now has quads, and the final board is ace, eight, three, six, ace with four hearts. What do you think now?
It's fun. This is a fun spot. Given everything you just said, boy, I think you got to chuck it to him again. If he's got nothing, I think that's the best way to... it's hard to think you're going to induce a bluff by betting. If for some reason he has no showdown value still, I think checking is the play. If he does have showdown value in his state of mind, I think he's going to put in a bet, probably. Probably with any flush, maybe. Boy, even if you put like the seven of hearts in his hand, he's just lost all that, and this old nit in the big blind could have an ace pretty easily, and he knows his image. I think he'd probably bet there. You feel silly when you check it all the way, and then he gets checked behind. But I think this is a good spot to check. I would check. What do you think?
I see the appeal of that. I think it's pretty close between trying to check raise or just bet. I think the really important consideration is how thinly will villain value bet. As we've said, I really don't think we're likely to see bluffs at this point.
Yeah.
I just think whatever he has when he checks back the flop on the turn, he just thinks he has showdown value. Yeah. And I don't think the river really does anything to like shipwreck any hand that he thought had showdown value at an earlier point. The turn does that a little bit, but I think the fact that he didn't bluff the turn means that he still thinks he has showdown value on the turn, and I don't think the river changes anything. So in terms of how wide should he or will he value bet the river? I mean, if I'm in his shoes, trying to value bet the seven of hearts seems pretty dicey to me. Just because, I do think there's a very good chance at the best hand. I just think it's pretty tough to get called, and if you do get check raised here on the river, it's a pretty big disaster. And the fact that the board paired on the river, and specifically that the card that paired is an ace, I mean, it does open up some full houses. I mean, I'm not necessarily thinking quads for the hero, but I am thinking full houses are possible for him. So there's actually a fair number of hands that beat a hand like seven of hearts, even with the hero checking three times. And I think that the right, you know, disciplined sort of play for the villain to make in this spot is to check behind. I think the nine of hearts is the point where it's a little closer in terms of whether I would bet it. I think I would certainly bet the ten of hearts if I'm in villain shoes. But I also think that a lot of the, like, even if he does bet a seven of hearts, I don't think he's likely to call a check raise with it, and I think he will call a bet with it, so I don't know that we really lose that much by checking to him. Like, I don't think there are very many hands that he's going to value bet and not call a bet with, or that he's going to, I also don't think his bet call range is going to be that wide. I think that once hero shoves, he's going to get a lot of folds. I think, you know, similar to the reason why we didn't shove preflop, it's just going to look extremely strong once hero check raises. So I don't know that we're really getting a second bet in as a result of check raising that much. I think mostly we're going to induce bets from the same hands that would call a bet, and there probably is going to be some range that would call a bet but will not bet, and I don't know that villain's bet call range is really going to be that wide.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think... Yeah, I probably think he will bet the seven of hearts more often than you think he will. Yeah, what about a hand like two blackjacks? What do you think he would do with that? That's a hand that he might call, but not. I think that's a more likely hit candidate for a hand that would call a bet, but would not bet itself.
Yeah, I think so, and I also don't think that stuff is a huge part of his range. I mean, I know we're kind of looking at the margins because there's not that many hands where it makes a difference in the first place, but...
Well, I mean, is it... the black kings, black queens, black jacks, black tens, black nines.
Yeah,
every combination of those opens before the flop.
That's true.
Maybe every single combination of them checks the flop, and maybe the turn also.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And given how hard a time we're having putting him on other things, like, I now
yeah,
think...
he's got to have something.
Yeah, so that's, what, 6 minus 3? Three combinations of each, 9, 10, jack, queen, king, 15 combinations total? Is that right?
Well, if we're just looking at the black ones...
Or sorry, not black. I mean, non-flushing. Non-flushing. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah. Three choose two is three. Three times five is 15. Good. So I think now I like a bet a little bit more now that I've thought about those 15 combos. If you want to bet about whether he'd bet the seven of hearts, I'll take the yes side, and I'll even lay you a little bit.
Well, I think the more important point is it doesn't matter. Like, he's gonna call it. He's not gonna bet call it. I don't think.
Probably not. Probably
so I think
not.
You know, either he calls a bet or he bets doesn't really make check raising better, is because he's gonna bet the seven of hearts.
Yeah, possible. I think sometimes you get a tilt call, but I see the point. I think, you know, less important is that he might just call with like threes full, but bet call with it. Unlikely, but there you go. Also, I think he'll show up with the king of hearts here sometimes. it's a reasonable hand to check the flop for all the reasons you said. There are also reasons to check it on the turn, depending on the physical read you get. Like, so I think villain will show up here with the nut flush sometimes.
What do you think in terms of sizing if hero does bet? We've got 10.8k in the pot so far and about 40k in the effective stacks.
I think you have to make it possible to be red for a bluff. I don't see a particular reason to go small, especially since, given the villain's a little bit tilty, I don't really see him making a good disciplined fold. Or if he does, I think he's as likely to do it to a small bet as to a big one.
What about inducing a raise? Like, so, I mean, I think you mentioned before the possibility that he might just call with a low boat.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like the king of hearts is another hand that I think, you know, is really should not raise a big bet, but might raise a small one.
Yeah.
And then there may also be some hands in his range that will call small bets and not big ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially the like pocket nines, type hands.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. So maybe like 5,100 or something.
That's what I was thinking. So yeah. Somewhere like half the pot gives him room to, I mean, for all the same reasons that you're thinking he would want to bet the seven of hearts. Yeah. I think that if he gets this far and he still has like the king or queen of hearts in his hand and just faces like a half pot bet from the hero, I think he might, either for good reasons or for tilty reasons, decide to try to put in a little raise with that. I think if he has a full house, he would certainly raise a half pot bet. But I think you're right that against a bigger bet, he probably should not and may not raise it. And I also think there are some hands like the pocket jacks without a heart that might be willing to call half pot, but not call full pot or not call 8K.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like that. And, I also think, boy, I mean, I've seen some really spazzy stuff, both in the bet, beyond the bet calling side. Like, I think I'm a little bit less pessimistic than you are that the hands that will bet will overwhelmingly fold to a raise. But you may have talked me into betting this hand. That said, there's another option for bet sizing that we haven't talked about yet, but we should let Ed talk about it.
Ed says, I tanked for over a minute considering all of my options. Checking, betting small, betting two-thirds of the pot, overbetting, etc. But without a range for villain, it was difficult to come up with a bet size. I was about to bet 8K into the 10.8K pot, and then I asked myself, if he would call 8K 60% of the time, then would he call 41K 12% of the time? I figured if he held the king or queen of hearts, he would call, and maybe even the jack. If he had a set, all the money was going in anyway, so I ignored that. And if he held a small heart, then shoving would be a losing play. All in all, it seemed like that rare spot where a 4x shove might be the right play. So that is what I did. In retrospect, I think the meta reasons shoving was a good idea. He was tilting and clearly likely to bluff catch. Clearly liked to bluff catch. We're offset by the reason why it was a bad idea, that middle-aged, well-dressed guys don't do things like this as a bluff. In hindsight, I wonder if a small blocking bet was the best play, as it would get value from his small hard hands and would probably raise for value with his stronger hands. Well, you already know how I feel about that last sentence, that I think that would be my preferred play. And I think Ed is right as well, that not only is this not the sort of thing that a guy who looks like him would do as a bluff, I just don't think... the thing is, the bigger you bet, the more polarized you need to be. You know, like, there are hands that that you could value bet for 8K that you couldn't value bet for 40K. So the idea that villain is going to call a shove with king or queen of hearts, he might as well have the deuce of hearts if you shove 40K. You know, like, you're not jamming with the queen of hearts to the point where it's relevant whether or not villain has the king of hearts. Some of your opponents might not be kind of savvy enough to pick up on that, but I think that in this case, I don't think the villain is likely to say, like, this doesn't strike me as a player who's likely to say to himself, I can't fold the king of hearts here even for 40K, so I'm going to call. You know, I think that when you jam, you're really representing either a boat or a bluff. And the fact that villain, you know, might have the king of hearts isn't going to be relevant. I think the fact that you block a lot of the boats that might call you, like, because you have pocket aces, it's pretty hard, or it's impossible for villain to have aces full. So you really block a lot of the boats that might be in his calling range, or even ace-x actually becomes a better bluff catcher for him, arguably, than the queen of hearts does, and you're blocking that. So I think this is a particularly unappealing spot to shove. Not that I would necessarily have a shoving range in this spot at all, but even if I did, I don't think aces is a good candidate for it.
I agree. I mean, what would you do with, if you got to the river with eights full and you faced a shove, what would you do?
If I'm villain?
Yeah.
That's a good point. I mean, I feel like I would probably just like call, but it's not, I mean, again, like, I think ace king is a better call than pocket aces.
Threes full?
Fold.
Yeah. Don't shove. Don't shove. But I like the creativity. Man, this is, I like, when I first read this hand, I didn't consider an overbet, and that's the wrong thing to do. You gotta, like full points for considering it, and then, you know, just in that moment being willing to consider the play.
I think for the same reasons that I respect the preflop slow play, I respect the fact that the villain was willing to do what, again, I think is actually the more risky option here. Not risky in the sense of losing the pot, obviously, but risky in the sense of, you know, he recognizes that he's going to he's going to get called a lot less often. And again, a lot of people would sort of rather have the bird in the hand rather than even an appropriately proportionately larger number of birds in the bush, as it were.
Yeah.
I think that's respectable.
I think it is. That said, a lot of people like to quote unquote make up for lost time when they haven't gotten value. And there's the, I think it was never called the Todd Terry theorem, but Todd Terry on 2+2 used to say, when somebody who you don't recognize in a live tournament makes a big overbet out of nowhere, he has the nuts. At least disproportionately often. And this hand is an illustration of that, I think. So I'm not sure it's so unusual to try to, you know, go for all the birds when you have the nuts, but I do applaud the open-mindedness. So
there's one other thing that I want to address, which is when Ed says if Villain would call 8K 60% of the time, then would he call 41K 12% of the time? And what he's getting at here is that if you know it he's going to call a little more than five times as many chips one-fifth as often, then that play is going to have a higher expected value. And in Chip EV terms, that's true. In a tournament, we are at the case of diminishing returns, where each chip that you add to your stack is worth a little bit less than the chips already in your stack. And I think especially when the hero only has 40K, winning 8K is worth more than, or sorry, winning 41K is not worth five times winning 8K. I think that picking up that 8K 60% of the time would be preferable to me to picking up 41K 12% of the time. Now, if you start making that, you know, picking up 50 or 55K 12% of the time, that's a different story. But I think there is some ICM effect here, or some
ICM. Wait. Yeah, sorry, not to cut you off. I mean, there's some ICM effect. Then there's having a 40K stack on day three of the main event when you're going to have ICM handcuffs on in like 100 or 200 hands of play. Like, this is the ICM spot of the whole year because, I mean, the payouts are usually crazy in such a way that it's correct to try to make the money with a medium to short stack such as the hero has. I mean, if there's one time in the year when you want to pick up a slightly bigger pot as opposed to going for it all, it's this. This is one of the most severe ICM spots you can get outside of a final table. Okay. So this is the time for it. Also, this calculation assumes that Villain never raises, which I think is probably not right. So, okay, so there's my rant. Yeah.
Results.
Yeah.
It says, Villain tanked for 45 seconds, said, "You don't just want some, you want it all, huh?" And then tanked for another minute, which again causes me to lose respect for the Villain.
Yeah.
At this point, I was convinced my shove was the right play, even if he folded, as he clearly was considering a call. He finally folded his hand face up, 10-7 of hearts. While he was tanking, I decided to show my hand if he folded, as I thought there would be a good chance of me being in reshove territory soon, and it would help my image for the table to know I had some ace combos in my flatting range. I almost never show hands, but I thought this was a rare exception. Was this a good idea?
No. No, it wasn't a good idea. No, for a lot of reasons.
I convinced Ed of that by email already.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. Number one is that you've played this hand in an unorthodox way, and you've given away a lot of information about how you play for nothing. Second, and less obviously, but I think very importantly, is that it's very few people who can flop a set and not give off any sort of physical indications of it. You did tank for a long time. Everybody was looking at you, at least the observant people were, as you were tanking. You gave off a lot of physical information, and not showing your hand makes it harder for them to interpret it. And this is the sort of situation where like I've offered opponents cash money to show me their hands, which is a good investment when you're playing for millions, by the way. Giving somebody $20 over the table, it's actually one reason I keep money with me during the main event. So
Mark Foss once offered me $100 to see my hand in the first main event that I played, and I didn't even consider it. I was like, if it's worth $100 to him, I definitely don't want to do it.
Yeah. So there's that. And third, like, when somebody shows a strong hand, I mean, maybe on day three of the main event, this is a little bit different, but usually what most people will consider is that, you know, that person is trying to make me think that they're tight so that they can steal later. Like, that, I think, is the default reaction, not like, golly gee, this person is so tight. I
will say sometimes people just like to show, like, if they have quads, they just want to show that they had quads just because it doesn't happen that much.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I do generally agree when you have someone showing, it's like they're trying to garner respect.
Yeah. So I don't like showing this hand, but I do like so many things about how he played this hand. And then he wrote into the
podcast. He thought through it as well.
He thought through it. He wrote to the podcast. He it sounds like he didn't really fudge the numbers to make himself look better. He admitted his mistake. I mean, this is somebody who's getting better at poker, I think. And
he included really results, which we appreciate. And which, yes, the audience appreciates.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, here's to you, Ed. Thanks for writing.
One final result from Ed. He said he made day four, but did not cash.
Sad trombone dot wave.
Yeah, and unfortunately, in terms of results, I still do not have a result from my WRGPT hand, so I cannot tell you whether I've doubled up with my set, tripled up with my set, or busted to a river flush. Yeah. But keep an eye on Twitter, and I'll brag about it one way or the other.
Sounds good. But I do have a WRGPT.
I've already bragged about it by the time you hear this.
Yeah. I do have an update from during the podcast. I folded queen nine offsuit to a cold 3-bet.
Good fold.
Feel good about that. All right, let's go get Brad. Hello.
This is Brad.
Hi, it's Nate. How are you?
I'm doing well, Nate. How are you?
Doing well. You here, Andrew?
I am. Thank you for joining us, Brad.
No problem at all.
It's truly a pleasure to talk to you. I've been enjoying your writing for a long time.
Well, it's fun. I've been following your career along the way, and listening in on the podcast when I can. And it's when you popped up, I'm like, do I really have the stones to go on with these guys? Because you guys are quite a bit smarter than I am. I figured, why not?
I think probably most people are going to know you or be most familiar with your work from the PokerStars blog. What precisely is your job title? I mean, are you the editor, or what exactly is your relationship with them?
Yeah, my job title's changed several times over the course of the last 11 years, but currently I'm called the head of blogging, which, frankly, while a title that I actually came up with, a title that I hate.
Well, we can, I guess, circle back around to that. So you're from Missouri originally?
Yeah, I grew up in Springfield, Missouri. I went to a little school just outside of Springfield, Missouri, Willard High School, and spent the first 18 years of my life there in the Bible Belt of Bible Belts, I mean, the true buckle of it. Left there planning to be a writer, and went up to Mizzou, which everyone's heard about a lot recently, where I entered every English class I could find and every cardigan professor I could find to sit around and listen to, and spent a couple of years doing that before I realized that I didn't want to be a professor with a cardigan sweater, and I needed to find something to do with my life. And about the same time, I ran into a girl who was in journalism school, and she said, hey, you should try this. And the next thing I knew, I was a journalist.
And did you grow up playing poker as well?
I did. My father, actually even my grandfather was a gambler.
I was just reading that article. I didn't quite finish it before we got on the phone.
Yeah.
Halfway through that article.
My grandpa wasn't a good gambler, and he was not necessarily the smartest gambler either. He was a Navy sailor back during World War II and had no chance of seeing any action whatsoever until he got busted playing dice a few times. And they shipped him out, and he was halfway across the Pacific when the war ended. So he managed to get away with it, which is sort of what Willis's, I think, have been doing pretty much ever since we've been around. So
he won the biggest gamble there was.
He did a great job, and it went on to have a whole bunch of kids, one of whom was my father. And my dad was a poker player and a gambler. He absolutely loved doing it. And I remember growing up, you know, we had the stacks of red, blue, and white plastic chips that you could buy in the little cardboard boxes and the bicycle cards, and we'd sit around the dinner table, and he'd bring in my friends, and he had no qualms about taking their money. And I remember, you know, that was my life from the time I was probably in middle school through high school, was playing cards with my buddies and my dad.
Was that a controversial thing for someone to be teaching their kids to gamble in the Bible Belt?
You know, perhaps so, because, I mean, all of my relatives, I mean, my grandfather was a preacher for a little while, despite the fact he was a gambler. And that sort of gives you the perspective that I'm coming from. I'm coming from a place to where your grandfather could be a preacher who was also a gambler. You know, there's two sides of everything, and that's what happened in Springfield, Missouri, a lot. And, you know, my dad always claimed to have bought my first crib with money he got playing. And so while it wouldn't have been something we would have done around the full Willis family Thanksgiving table, it was something that, you know, inside the house, you know, Dad was happy to do. And, you know, I was 20 years old the first time he took me to Las Vegas. And while I didn't have an ID that I could sit down and play, I would stand just on the rail of all places at the Excalibur. And my dad would sit there and play 2-6 spread limit or whatever it was at the time. And I'd just sit and watch him play. And he enjoyed it so much.
And it seems like the sort of thing that, you know, people will look at that and say, well, that sounds hypocritical, that there's someone who, you know, he's a preacher or whatever, and he's also gambling. But I guess it seems to me a lot of those folks, I mean, the reason they're so concerned about sin and temptation and whatnot is that they're familiar with it. It's not that they're free of those things. They're warning about those things because they kind of know the danger of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, growing up where I did, I mean, it was the whitest, most religious place in the world. And I mean, their Evangel College, which I think is now Evangel University, is there. The entire Assemblies of God Church is based around Springfield, Missouri. And it's, you know, a wonderful place to raise a family, but for the fact that you don't see a lot of the outside world. And it's only from people who maybe had been out a little bit that I started to learn a little bit about how cloistered I was in this environment growing up in Springfield. And, now I'm probably the same age my dad was. And when he was, you know, bringing me up and teaching me things, and I start to realize now that a lot of the things that I learned growing up just simply aren't true. A lot of the truisms about life and about America and about sin, or, you know, however you view sin, just aren't what I thought growing up. And, you know, I'm now a father of two kids, and I look at myself and I'm like, how can I teach my children the same things that I learned growing up and what I thought was an amazing childhood, when a lot of the things that I believed growing up turned out just not to be true?
Do you feel like a lot of the poker world kind of misunderstands that relationship between religion and poker, or the idea that, you know, religious people are anti-gambling or something like that?
You know, I think, you know, we all build up these walls and these soapboxes, I guess, that we stand on, and we want to have a cause that we can fight for. And so we find the differences among ourselves that end up dividing us even worse than before. But I know, I mean, and I think I'm sure you guys know as well, you know, even though someone who goes to church might be uncomfortable with the idea of gambling, or someone who is a full-time gambler might be leery of a person who goes to church, you guys know just as well as I do, you sit around the table, you're going to find people of all walks of life. I mean, there's a guy, actually a really popular, well-known online poker player that I played with here in Greenville for years, who always wore a cross around his neck, who never drank a drop of alcohol, who was the most godly person in the world, who ended up leaving America, continues to play, and is the most conservative, God-fearing man that you'll ever find, but also makes most of his living playing online poker.
Yeah, one of the first final tables that I made on PokerStars, I remember I ended up getting heads up with someone who was, and, you know, we were just like chatting because poker was still fun back then. he identified himself as a, you know, Christian fundamentalist or whatever, and I was asking him about the gambling thing, and he was like, "No, on my reading of the Bible, there's nothing in there against it."
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, and I think that's why, you know, as I've gone through the poker world for the past, you know, 11 years, I've found that there is no single poker player. There is no single story out there that defines us all, and that's how I've ended up being able to do what I do over the course of the last, you know, decade.
Have you been teaching your children to play?
You know, I haven't yet. They know about it. They're familiar with it. My oldest son is 11. My youngest son is 6. And they know what I do. They know where I go. They've watched it on television. They know who some of the big stars are. You know, they get the swag that I bring home that comes in the premium bags that they give out. You know, that my house is littered with, you know, Copag cards, you know, that my kids have played with. And they will learn the game. They want to learn the game. They ask me at the dinner table, Daddy, when are you going to teach us to play? And I will. But there are other things that I want them to learn first.
Just because you think those other things are more important, or because you think they're kind of prerequisites to learning poker?
Well, I mean, I think I would like them to learn their math a lot better before they start playing. You know, I mean, I was always the kid who liked to write, but my kids are showing a tendency toward some of the more science and math oriented things. And I want them to get those down, because they could end up being smarter than their dad, which would be fantastic.
How did you fall in with PokerStars?
That is a long story, but a crazy
time.
All right,
we'll be happy to bring you back for a second appearance if necessary.
Probably not. I'd love to come back. You probably won't want me back after this is over. But anyway, I was a television news reporter. I left Mizzou as a TV news reporter and bounced around, as TV news reporters do, from city to city, climbing from one job market to another. And it landed me here where I still am, in Greenville, South Carolina, working for an NBC affiliate here. And I was a crime and courts reporter. And during that time, I also was playing a lot of poker around town, not necessarily in the big underground games, but home games and stuff like that, and had started playing online. And during that time, I was also blogging on a personal blog, and a friend of mine who was a poker player said, we should start some sort of poker blog. So in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003, somewhere in there, we started up a little poker blog that we started writing on and wrote a lot about it. We wrote about, you know, going to Vegas. We wrote about our online poker stuff. And it was basically for our friends in a small community of poker bloggers that existed at that time. Little did we know that a guy named Will Wheaton, who some people know and some people don't, but the man who was in Stand By Me went on to be in Star Trek and has since turned that entire thing into a life as a writer, actor, you know, convention speaker, basically all around celebrity and good guy.
I think of him as kind of a professional nerd.
And you know what? I think he'd be happy with that description. You know, he came up with the Wheaton's Law: don't be a dick. And it's if I can teach my kids anything, that's the one thing. But anyway, that's, you know, Will. For those who know Will, know that back in that time, he had started getting into poker and writing about poker a little bit. PokerStars was getting ready to have the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure, the first one they were going to have at Atlantis. The first year in 2004, they had done it on a cruise ship, but that was too small, so they moved to Atlantis. And the first year, Lee Jones had written sort of daily reports from the boat and sent them out on the PokerStars website. But Lee Jones and the rest of PokerStars at the time wanted something bigger. They wanted more writing. They wanted more coverage about it. And I believe it was Dan Goldman, who at the time was the head of marketing for PokerStars. Either he or Lee, or both of them together, got together and said, Will Wheaton would be perfect for this because, you know, he recently played in a WPT celebrity event, and we think he would be great. So they called up Will and they said, hey, dude, would you come down to the Bahamas and write about this event for us? And the thing that changed my life was that Will didn't have time to do it. And he said, but I've been reading this poker blog from this guy, and you might try him out. So one night in December of 2004, I was literally like getting ready to get on a plane to go to Vegas. And I got a message from Lee Jones saying, hey, give me a call when you get a chance. And he was asking me if I wanted to go to the Bahamas and write about this thing, because Will Wheaton, of all people, had recommended me for it. So I went to Vegas. I got on the old television internet system and sent Lee a couple of writing samples, and went down to the PCA that year and wrote about the PCA for a week. And at the end of that week, I looked over and Lee Jones and Mark Sheinberg and Dan Goldman and Rich Corbin were all sitting there sort of whispering to each other. And then Lee motioned me over to the other side of the office that we were working in, and he said, how would you feel about doing this all the time? And I thought about it. At that point, I'd been in television for, you know, almost a decade, and you know, it was my career and what I expected to be doing at that point. And I thought, well, I don't know. But I said, this was a lot of fun, and I'd really enjoy it. And a week later, so I said, let me think about it, but I'd love to hear the details. A week later, I'm on the phone with Esai Scheinberg talking to him. That's one of the more terrifying things that's ever happened to me. And a week later, I turned in my 2 weeks notice to WYFF television and got on a plane to Copenhagen, Denmark. And from there, I went to Deauville, France. And there, I went to Vienna and to Monte Carlo. And almost 11 years later, here we are.
Did that feel like a gamble at the time? Did it feel like you were doing something mildly irresponsible?
Yeah, absolutely. And from the eyes of everyone who had been watching me up to that point, it seemed like the most ridiculous thing you could possibly do. The people around me at this point already wondered what in the hell I was doing with my life as I spent my evenings playing online poker tournaments, you know, until 3 or 4 in the morning, and then get up and go and work, television news from 9 to 7 every day. It didn't make any sense for a guy to be one of the first people in his family to graduate from college with a journalism degree, go through 3 different jobs, 3 different states, all of a sudden just give it up, say, I'm done with television, to go write about, of all things, poker. And for me, my wife, we had just had our first child. He was, our child at that point was 5 months old, I think. And we just had our first child. My wife had a job. And I said, I think this is what we need to do. This might be our future. And my wife, while she hates gambling, she's not averse to risk. she said, it's all right. Let's roll with it. And,
she was supportive from the beginning.
She was. The thing about television is, and anyone who's been in the business, it's a job that you have to keep moving constantly. You never put down roots anywhere. And until such point that you've made it to, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, or the network, you're moving constantly, and you never get to find a home. And we've sort of felt like we'd found a home here in the South anyway. And I wasn't getting any, despite the fact that I had, done some really cool things and done a lot of great things for this TV station I worked for, I wasn't going anywhere there. I wasn't going to be a big dog at that station, and I wasn't going to make any money. And, poker, both playing and writing about it, offered me an opportunity to make some money, and it worked out, of all things.
You mentioned feeling like you grew up in a very kind of cloistered place. I imagine then reporting on crime in courts was a pretty big 180 from.
It was. Despite the fact I grew up, in a conservative area, my dad was what, we always called a rubbernecker. It didn't matter where the sirens were or, what smoke he saw on the horizon. He wanted to go figure out what was happening. And I thought, I like telling stories, and I'm the son of a rubbernecker, of all things. And so when I got up to Mizzou, I gravitated toward crime stories and ended up doing what at the time was Central Missouri's biggest crime story ever, where a man had gone on a killing spree that across the state, and one of the biggest manhunts in Missouri history. And I got caught up right in the middle of it. And it hooked me. And from then on, it didn't matter, who was dead, why they were dead, I was there.
When you started off covering the tournaments for Poker Stars, are there mistakes you feel like you made in the beginning, things that, looking back on it, you think you were kind of picking up on the wrong sorts of stories or covering things in the wrong sorts of ways? Or I guess, was there anything that kind of surprised you about what that job ended up entailing?
I think what surprised me was how quickly the competition sprang up. At the time, there weren't many people doing online live reporting. From the PCA, I was doing hand-for-hand action, having never seen it, done before. I was just doing it because it seemed like the right thing to do. And at the time, there were very few people, almost nobody, who was doing hand-for-hand coverage. BJ Nemeth was about the same time doing it for Card Player magazine, but there wasn't any competition. And so there wasn't any way to feel like I'm doing this right or wrong, because there wasn't anything to compare it to. That changed, pretty quickly. By the 2005 World Series, the media had started to grow just a little bit. And by the 2006 World Series, trying to fight for a spot in the Amazon room was impossible. It was scary. And I think if I had had any vision whatsoever, I would have seen, this age of poker reporting coming, where even live updates now are somewhat passe. You know, everyone wants a stream these days. So I think, you know, of the mistakes I made, it was probably just not looking far enough ahead to what might be coming. And, you know, while I feel like I was part of like an innovation 10 years ago, you know, I've had to keep up with the young kids, you know, both in the game and on, you know, in the reporting side of it.
Is there something you think you could have done differently if you had seen that coming?
Yeah, I think if I'd had it to do over again, I probably would have worked on our technology in our reporting a little bit better and pushed for it a little bit harder. And I mean, honestly, for the first 2 or 3 years we were doing the Poker Stars blog, we were doing it straight off, you know, blogger software. And it was, for the time, it wasn't terrible, but, you know, we didn't have any, you know, built-in native engines for running content. And I wish now, looking back, that I had thought a little bit more about it and pushed a little bit harder for that kind of thing. We're still evolving, and I still want to do more, and we're going to do more. But I think looking back, I wish that I had taken a little bit more time to think about the technological developments that were to come.
Do you miss that era when everything was new and sorry?
I said, God, yes, I do.
me too. What exactly?
Well, you know, man, I guess people think, you know, Brad's old. He tends to romanticize stuff a little bit. But I look back to the 2005-2006 World Series and a lot of the EPTs that were going on there, and I was pulling my laptop right up to the final table, literally like had a chair sitting next to the final table for event, you know, World Series bracelet events. Yeah. I was literally on the stage sitting there, you know, during the main events while, you know, they were running things. The media room at the World Series for that 2005 World Series was barely, you know, my bonus room in my house is bigger than that. and guys were sitting around with bottles full of whiskey, you know, talking. And I remember this one Irish writer sat down and started to write. And he goes, I can't write sober. Went to the liquor store, came back, put a bottle of liquor down and started drinking in the middle of the media room. And you just don't see that these days. But, you know, access was so much easier back then because, you know, the poker media was smaller and the stories were bigger. And the people were different. I mean, you know as well as I do, the people, you know, of 10 years ago in poker are so much different than the people now. And this isn't to say anything about the young guys who've come up and taken over the game. They did what they, you know, they did the smart thing and they took over the game. But back then, there were the diversity of people you would see at the table was so much more. I mean, I think back to, you know, 10, 11 years ago, there was a guy, his name was Jim Hamburger. Seriously.
I like him already.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Smiling, retiree. He played senior baseball down in Florida. And his online stream name was Down the Line. And he was so happy just to be interviewed and to have his story told after qualifying for the World Series. And now you don't see that anymore. You don't see all the old or even just different qualifiers come in. Because, you know, I mean, as far as Poker Stars goes, there aren't any qualifiers to the World Series anymore. And, you know, whether it's American or whether it's anywhere else, you just don't see as many stories popping up. And so I miss those times where it was smaller. And I mean, the players were bigger and the media was smaller, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Another problem is that amateurs, frankly, if they're not good, they're drawing dead. Not drawing dead, but drawing way thinner than they used to be. And you still get some people making runs on luck, but you know, if Jim Hamburger is more worried about getting better at baseball than at getting better at poker, it's going to be a lot longer shot for him to make the money or make a final table.
Oh yeah, I mean that I long for the days of having people show up at the final two or three tables who aren't the sunglasses, hoodie, robotic people. And again, I'm not going to say anything bad about the young guys who've come up and, you know, turned being a poker robot into a good career because, you know, hell, good for them, right? Yeah. But that doesn't make my job any easier. And it makes poker less fun to watch. You know, I mean, and we all watched the World Series broadcast, you know, last week. And, you know, there were the second day of it was so much better than the first because the first day there was no conversation. Yeah. There was nothing. There was nothing for people to watch other than, you know, the chips moving back and forth. And I've long been a proponent, and you know, probably way past the point I should have stopped talking about it, for you know, making the characters of poker more part of poker. And I know that, you know, young folks don't want to hear it. You know, they, you know, it's a game, it's a grind, it's math. But, you know, for me, half the fun of poker, if not more, both playing and writing about it, is the people.
Yeah. Are there other characters besides Joe Hamburger you remember from the Golden Days?
Oh, I mean, there were all kinds of people. I mean, I think back, I mean, not even just like writing about them, but just being around them. You know, these guys who would hold up the Rio. They're the type of, you know, guys, the sort of smarmy, didn't necessarily smell particularly great, but had been at the Rio for 4 or 5 days, you know, taking buy-ins off people and trying to make that score. You know, I mean, those kinds of crazy stories that you know, yeah, the old pros that existed back then. I think of Eskimo Clark. You know, that man was a story. Every time he walked into a room, nothing good was going to happen necessarily. It was a damn good story, no matter what happened. It was fun just to watch him be. You know, to watch him be there. I mean, it didn't matter whether you know he was going to have some terrible illness at the table, or he was going to you know launch into somebody over some you know ill-conceived or misperceived slight. You know, he was a story. There were so many fun stories back then. Right. I wish I could say that, and maybe it's my fault. Hey, maybe it's my fault. Maybe I'm not looking hard enough at the tournaments these days for some of those good stories. But boy, it sure seemed like they were easier to find back then.
I mean, Alex Powers and Jim McManus yakking at each other at a final table was pretty amazing. And then the next year you could see Alex Powers like wandering around the Amazon room trying to sell you something. I think he was working on a commission for some cigarette company or something. So, yeah. You know, I turned around one day and there's Alex Powers like trying to hawk something. It was amazing.
Yeah, I saw him trying to get free popcorn. There was a popcorn machine in the rotunda of the World Series one year, and he was like trying to get free popcorn from the popcorn lady. I mean, it's you know that. Think about that. Think about McManus and Alex Powers back then. Every one of us watched that on television and thought that is what I'm going to Vegas for. You know, I mean, I want to go find that guy, and I want to try to play against him. And these days, you know, do I want to go to Vegas and play against the guy that just won the World Series of Poker? No, I don't ever want to play against him. Nice guy. Love to have a beer with him, but I don't want to play against him.
How much of this do you think is players getting better and just focusing more on playing their cards right as opposed to being social? Or just being pros in the first place? And how much of it do you just think is Apple's fault and the smartphone and people aren't there to talk to each other at the poker table anymore?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point. I mean, we as a society have disconnected almost entirely. You know, I mean, we aren't, if it's not showing up in our Twitter feed or on our Facebook feed or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever the hell they're talking about today, we don't necessarily pay attention to it, which is why half the damn problems we have in the world happen anyway. But I think it's also one other thing. This is probably the thing that'll get me in trouble more than anything. But, you know, we talk about the qualifiers of the old days and how that brought more older people into the game. And by older, I mean my age. I'm 41 years old. You know, it brought in the middle-aged guys or the retirees or even the, you know, the 30-year-old dads with a single kid. And today, the guys who are the most successful in the game are more often than not your early 20s to late 20s guys. And I say this with the caveat that it is not their fault that this is the case, but they don't have as much life experience.
Sure.
They know the game better than anybody out there and they can crush the game. But, you know, they haven't had to change a diaper yet. They haven't had to worry about what, you know, if their mortgage payment was going to come through or they got laid off or, you know, that, you know, that their wife has cancer or whatever. I mean, they haven't necessarily had a lot of the life experience that the other people, you know, in the older days had. And, you know, that's not their fault. That's just simply the case.
Yeah, so instead of somebody who's done 2 tours in Korea, et cetera, winning a bracelet, it's somebody who's played 3.7 million hands of poker and is 23 years old, and the former is probably going to be a better interview, is that, or more exciting person to play with?
Or someone who is just perhaps has more to say. You know?
I mean, absolutely.
Don't get me wrong, I've met a lot of the young guys, and some of them are very friendly and they are eager to talk about the game, but you know, when your life is the game, then that's all we're going to talk about. And you know, oftentimes I think people might want to, you know, read about something that isn't just, you know, how Ace King beat Jacks again.
Do you see a way for poker to get out of that? Are there formats of poker that could encourage, you know, different kinds of people to play or somehow shake that up?
You know, I we've all been talking about this for, you know, the past several years, you know, especially since PokerStars left America. And, you know, I mean, I think as soon as when PokerStars makes it back to America and there are qualifiers, you know, a lot more online satellites and things like that, you're going to see a lot more different people coming into the game. I think just having different faces, different stories come in will help. People who aren't necessarily so reticent at the table, people who might want to engage in conversation, which would then improve televised poker. And I still love televised poker. I still think that, you know, the stuff they do on EPT Live with PokerStars and the World Series broadcast, I still love watching it, but it's not as fun to watch as it used to be. And it's because you're not learning about necessarily people. You're not hearing their stories. So, you know, if you can bring more people in, I don't know that there's another format of another game that makes things that would make poker more exciting for more stories. But I think if people saw real people like themselves on television winning lots of money, then you would see a lot more new stories come in. And if that's not the case, and we don't see that happen, then I think, you know, I think the people who are playing the game now might want to think a little bit farther down the road and try to, you know, encourage poker to become more entertaining for people who aren't there.
There are people who have proposals, you know, like this, you know, add a little bit to the prize pool, and in exchange for playing the tournament, you consent to wearing a suit at the final table, leaving your smartphone at home, and letting a makeup person spend 5 minutes on you before you show up. You know, and say there are a bunch of suits just there waiting for people who make the final table, so that it's harder to not talk to people, and it's going to look a little more TV friendly. Does a proposal like that, where you have the same people and just somewhat different guidelines, appeal to you at all?
You know, I've never necessarily cared as much about how, you know, about a person's sartorial choices. You know, I mean, if a guy wants to show up wearing a Lakers jersey, let him show up wearing a Lakers jersey.
You were waxing romantic about Eskimo Clark a minute ago.
that man never showed up wearing, you know, anything that I'd feel comfortable wearing, especially after he wore it. But anyway, I think people need to recognize that television is meant to be entertainment. And television has things that make reality television has things that make it more entertaining. Now, some of those things aren't necessarily the truest things, and I'm not saying we need to lie, but I do think that if players paid more attention to the idea that they were on television, then they could do more to improve the game. Now, forcing anyone into doing that, I think, is probably going to be a non-starter. I mean, as much as I would love for it to happen, I don't know how many players are going to feel comfortable being forced into something. Now, some of the rules you talk about would be interesting. You know, they're, you know, making a dress code, not letting them wear hats, not letting them wear sunglasses, not letting them have electronics at the table. Those are all things that I think that possibly could be implemented, but I think you'd have to think about your player base and what they might want to do. I would certainly love to see, as far as I'm concerned, I don't care what they wear, I don't care what they do, I just want to see them interact at the table. I want it to seem as a social game, because that's the reason I start, that's the only reason I play poker anymore at all, is just for the social aspect of it. And if the social aspect isn't there, I'd rather be reading a book.
Now, I know this isn't specific to poker, because, you know, if you watch the Olympics, like, half of that coverage is about people's lives outside of their sport. But isn't it a little ironic that we're saying, you know, poker media, poker blog, whatever, we want to be able to focus on more non-poker stuff? Like, we don't want to just talk about poker. We have to find out about, you know, we have to have people who have more going on besides just poker.
Well, you know, I hear what you're saying. You're right. But I also think that if we care about poker going forward in any way other than, I mean, let me ask you a question. How many chess tournaments have you watched in the past? Yeah.
One.
How many bridge tournaments do we watch on TV?
Zero for me, but Nate might have a different answer.
Yeah, that's true. Right? So, I mean, if we want it to be more than a really small niche, we got to make it bigger. And now, I've always felt that my job is to help promote the game of poker. Now, I can write about poker all day long. I know the rules. I know, you know, the strategies. I know all the terminology, and I know the players. But if you want to read about it, sure. And Nate wants to read about it, sure. Mm-hmm. And maybe half the PokerStars blog readers want to read about it. But I want the guy who lives down the street to want to read about it. I want that guy who's never played poker to want to read about it. And, you know, if I'm not going to pique his interest by telling him about this really nuanced check raise that Vanessa Selps made. I'm just not. And as much as we need to, that's part of the job of reporting, we need to tell other stories. And I think that you will see that in almost every successful game. I mean, you turn on an NFL game at the beginning of the day, you're gonna hear about statistics and you're gonna hear about the various plays, but you're also gonna hear about, you know, what's going on in those players' lives. You know, the fact that Cam Newton's been dancing in the Tennessee end zone has pissed off a lot of people for the past week, and that's exactly why he did it, because he's on TV, he's now a franchise player, and it's going to get more press for the Carolina Panthers. And that is the type of thing that drives more people to listen and to watch. You know, if it's not going to pop off their Facebook page and it's not going to pop off their, you know, the front page of Twitter, then what good is it? You know, I mean, we're going to keep the same damn readers that we've had all the time. And, you know, as much as I value them and as much as they've helped support my family, I want more. I want more people in the game. I want more people to want to play. I want more people to read about it.
Sure. And I should say my intention in asking that question wasn't really to disagree with that as much as to say, you know, what is it about poker that, you know, why do we think poker even has the potential for that? You know, so, I mean, you say, you know, you're not watching chess on TV, you're not watching bridge on TV, and, I mean, maybe there are some, or in fact, I know there are some colorful people who play those games, but at the same time, they don't seem to have the same intrinsic relationship, at least in our imagination, to sort of, like, colorful and interest the way that poker does, especially to people who maybe aren't as inside of the poker world as we are. I think there's still that idea of poker as kind of like a interesting, slightly shady, kind of romanticized thing to do. Do you think that's something intrinsic to the game of poker, or do you think it's just the history or the vagaries of how it's evolved?
Well, I mean, it's probably a little bit of both, but I know I'll just speak for myself personally. I mean, I, like most, you know, many Americans anyway, played poker growing up, but I, at the same time, fell in love with the game when I started reading about the people who played it. And I started watching stories about the people who played it. I mean, I'll be the first person to admit, back in the late 1990s, I would pull up Phil Gordon and all the Tilt Boys stories and read them. I mean, at the time, I think I was working in Jackson, Mississippi, and I would pull up on my little monochrome monitor these stories and just read them when I should have been working, because they were fun stories. They were fun stories of guys playing 2-4 limit poker at the Luxor or whatever. And I wanted to be that guy. You know, I wanted to be that guy having a great time with his friends. And, you know, chess and bridge, you know, they're for really, really smart people, right? You have to study for years and you have to learn a lot. But poker, you know, even if you're not, you know, these days it seems like you really have to be smart to play poker. But back then, you know, you could be an average guy with an average education and jump into the game and do all right. And I think that's what makes poker different, is that it's accessible to everyone. You know, anyone who can learn, you know, a little bit of basic math and learn four suits can play the game. And it's probably the most accessible of any game or sport that's ever been on television. And because of that, it became popular. Now, if we want to talk about waning popularity now, there's a lot of, you know, probably other reasons for that happening too. But the accessibility in those early days made it the type of game that could explode on television.
I wonder too if part of that popularity has to do with what we were talking about earlier, and that, you know, the relationship between sin and gambling, and the idea that poker, at least for a long time, and in some places still is a thing that you can't do legally, and that a lot of people kind of frown upon. And so, on the one hand, it holds this kind of a dark fascination for people, or it has a bit of that air of the forbidden fruit. But also, it attracts people who are kind of on the margins and who are willing to do interesting things that are, you know, not necessarily 100% sanctioned by society. And so, you know, when you describe some of these colorful characters, they are people that you wouldn't necessarily want your daughter dating or whatever, even if you do think that they're interesting people.
Right. I mean, anyone who's met me knows I'm about the most average white guy in America. You know, I grew up in a family of four with a dog. I went to a state school. I graduated with a degree. I have a wife, two kids, two dogs, and I live in the suburbs. You know, I'm a straight-laced dude. But man, I loved the romance of going to a dark place where, you know, there's a guy that's got a gun in his boot, maybe, but you don't know, but maybe has a gun in his boot. You know, there's a cocktail waitress who probably came from the local strip club, maybe, who knows, but she's serving cocktails at the table. You know, I felt like I was doing something that was a little bit on the edge, but not so much so that, you know, I was not going to be able to go home to my wife at the end of the night. And, you know, listen, poker is a wonderful, wonderful game with some, you know, really dark romantic stories in its background. And despite the fact it's been, you know, under television lights for the past decade or more, it comes from some weird places. And it's really fun for me to be this guy who's at a neighborhood party. And people say, what do you do? I say, oh, I write about poker. And they say, poker? And all of a sudden, like the three or four guys, you know, who might have been standing on the edge have their heads leaned in and they want to hear about it. And they don't want their wives to know they're hearing about it. that's the appeal for a lot of people is that, you know, it's something a little bit dirty, a little bit naughty, but not so naughty that they're going to get divorced over it.
So do you think we're kind of in some ways shooting ourselves in the foot or undermining that dark appeal of poker a little bit by trying to normalize it and just kind of turn it into just another game like chess and the sort of thing that you can do legally anywhere, and if we're trying to separate it from that sense of taboo? But do you think we're shooting ourselves in the foot at all by doing that?
No, I don't think so, because as much as we can capitalize off the romance of the game, and as much as the stories of the romance of the game are great, both marketing material and just great stories to tell, we want it to appeal to a bigger group. And to do that, we have to sanitize it a little bit. You know, as much as I love telling the stories of poker games gone bad and, you know, things that have gone wrong and the romance of, you know, walking into a place I'd never been before, that's fun. You know, it was great for rounders and it was great for, you know, me and, you know, how I told stories. But when it's time to tell my mom what I'm doing, and it's time to tell, you know, my elderly neighbors, you know, what I do, you know, I'd much rather them see, you know, what's happening on television than what's happening down the street.
What do you think games like Hearthstone and Magic and League of Legends are doing right? Because for some reason, you know, video games are not seen as shady, but they are sort of looked down on by a lot of people. But these things are exploding in popularity. I can pull up ESPN3 and see Hearthstone finals, and they're just huge. Do you think that there's something that they're doing right that poker is not?
I think that they are probably capitalizing on the exact same phenomena that existed for poker 10 or 11 years ago, in that it, number one, is something new. It is something that young people can watch on their computers and enjoy. And the fact that as players, while there may not necessarily be a lot of money to be, or, you know, there's not millions to be made by winning a tournament, there's a hell of a lot of money in sponsorship. And it's an aspirational, they've turned it just like poker was, into an aspirational pursuit. If I'm a kid who's playing a game that has no other ill effects other than just the time it takes to do it, I can tell my parents, look, this guy right here is a superstar. He's a rock star. You know, he's making his living playing a video game. And because it's just as poker was, an aspirational pursuit, it can pull in thousands and thousands and thousands of young people who love watching it. And the people who put on these events know that very well. If they can sell the sponsors on it, then they can sell the kids on it, and then it becomes this circular money train. And I mean, poker was the same way, except for the fact that back in the day, poker was, you know, and even today, you know, still seen as somewhat illicit, whereas video games, with the exception of the time it takes to play them, aren't. And so that's what they're doing right now, is just capitalizing on the aspirational nature of the game and the fact that there's nothing really wrong with it other than the fact that it's a video game.
Makes sense. It's a little off subject, but I have to ask. Do you miss going by Brad Otis Willis?
Not at all.
Okay. I kind of miss it. I kind of miss it. You're always Brad Otis Willis to me.
You know, and I'm happy to answer to it. I seriously am happy to answer to it. In fact, Will Wheaton still exclusively calls me Otis, and there are several people. Paul McGuire still call me Otis exclusively, and I'm fine with it because that's who I was for a long time. I was simply Otis before I was Brad Otis Willis. Otis was, just for people who don't know, it was the name that I wrote under back before or when I was still in television. And it was a name I picked up because, number one, one of my grandfather, not the gambler, but the other one, his name was Otis. And there was Otis the Drunk from the Andy Griffith Show. And there was a musician named Mojo Nixon who had an album called Otis at one point. It was a name I picked up when I was in college. And I stuck with it as a pseudonym and had to slowly wean myself out of it because as much as it was fun for poker, if I ever want to write about anything else, I don't really want to see Otis in big orange letters at the top of a book.
What's the appeal that writing has for you outside of poker? I mean, obviously in poker, as much as you enjoy the game and whatnot, and you're making a living from it, but you've also got your personal blog, Rapid Eye Reality, where you write a lot of stuff just about kind of what's going on in your life. What's your impetus for doing that?
I've written since I was probably 3 years old and never stopped. Whether it was doing journaling, whether it was after I stopped journaling and I moved away from college for and all my friends, I would send emails back and just long form emails back to my friends from Mississippi that I called at the time the Deep South Update. And then after I started blogging in 2001 when a friend of mine recommended, you know, that it was a good way to channel some of the writing that I wanted to do. And I do it not for any other reason than I simply feel like I have to. It's therapy for me. Like any other person, whether, you know, it's actual therapy, you're sitting in a therapist's office, or it's sitting with a friend over a cocktail or whatever, writing is the only way that I can clarify the thoughts that I have in my head. I can spend all day, you know, scrolling through Twitter and wanting to fight with people, or scrolling through Facebook and really wanting to fight with people, or I can sit down and pound out something on my computer screen that clarifies the thoughts that are in my head. I can form all these thoughts about how terrible the world is and how things are falling apart, and all the existential crises that, you know, a middle-aged man with two kids goes through. I can funnel all of that down to one page, and if I want somebody to see it when it's done, I can throw it up. And if not, I can put it in the little hidden file that I have that has about 18 times what I've ever published in the back of it. But it's therapy. It's simple therapy for me, and I've been very lucky to be able to get paid for my own personal therapy.
Does it ever get controversial among, you know, that you're kind of writing about people in your life? I mean, do any of them, like, not necessarily want that stuff up on the internet?
You know, I would say that no one has ever complained. I take that back. A couple of people have complained over the course of the years. I think the point that Lee Jones actually set me straight on something one day, only by asking a question. I write a lot about my kids because my kids have become a gigantic, if not all of my life. And, you know, Lee asked me one day, you know, how do you think your kids are going to feel later on in life that their entire life, you know, has been chronicled here, you know, in this place? And it was only a question. He wasn't, you know, saying anything about what I'd written or whatever else. But, you know, it was a question that made me think. You know, do my kids have a right to privacy that I'm not necessarily granting them by writing about them here? And there's a writer who wrote for Esquire for a long time. I think he's on a sabbatical right now, named Chris Jones. One of my favorite writers out there. He's written for ESPN the magazine and Esquire. And his son is autistic. And he had written something about his son publicly that the trolls just came out of the woodwork on it. And it made him decide he would never, ever write about his kid again. And that also gave me a great deal of pause that while my readership isn't as big as his, you know, I have to be careful about what I do with my family. And, you know, my wife and I joke about, you know, the Facebook reality. You know, you look at anybody's Facebook page, you're not getting a real glimpse of what their real life is like. You know, you get the best picture of them with their chin, you know, in the air so that they'll have a double chin, and you know, their makeup's perfect, you know, and they're not getting divorced and they're not behind on their marriage and their kid hasn't just, you know, puked all over his bedroom. You're getting the Facebook reality of it. You know, so while I don't ever lie in what I write, I don't always tell, you know, I'm not going to tell you the stories of what happened with my family over the past couple of weeks, because, you know, those are the type of things that you keep in your house. And so that was, if you say controversial, I've never gotten in a lot of trouble, but I have, you know, had to be very careful about what I decide I'm going to write about, because even my own personal views, whether it's about race or whether it's about foreign policy or whether it's about anything, you know, my neighbors read what I write, and my kids' friends' parents read what I write. And I have to be careful about that. As much as I don't want to, as much as I just want to puke all over the screen all day long, I got to be careful, because there are people I love that are affected by what I write.
Do the kids' friends' parents, has your job or your interest in poker ever been controversial?
You know, I won't say that it's been controversial, but you learn who your friends are pretty quickly. Over the course of time, suburban married with kids people, you know, you go to a lot of functions and you end up at swim meets and football games and baseball games, and you learn pretty quickly who's comfortable dealing with someone who works in this kind of industry and who isn't. And, you know, I'm the type of guy who my entire life I've known who my friends are. And so having a job in an industry that helps further define that is great. And I'm not saying that anyone's ever just gotten up and walked away from me when I told them what I did. But, you know, those people don't come back around for conversations anymore.
Well, we're trying to do our part with this show to find whatever colorful characters are still left in the poker world. Is there anyone that you would suggest we talk to, or even just places you suggest we look?
You know, I find that, you know, over in Europe, there's a lot of young people who I think are really, really smart, who aren't necessarily getting their due, or people who've been there forever. One of my favorite people ever, and, you know, is a guy named Ben Grundy, who was the Milky Bar kid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's not new. He's my age or so, but he's been around forever. Smart guy, really smart guy. But, you know, I never like to tell people who they should go out and interview, because everyone's going to look at a story a little bit different. You know, I'm fascinated with Steve O'Dwyer. Steve O'Dwyer is one of the most fascinating people in the world to me, but it's very rare to see a story written about him because he's so focused on what he's doing. And I would love to get, I would love someone who is ready to just, you know, take a person to the depths of their personality, interview Steve O'Dwyer and see what he has to say.
That's a tough challenge.
No kidding.
You're not the first person to mention his name, though.
Yeah. He's a great guy. He's an absolutely great guy. I just want to know more about him.
What about not necessarily specific people, but just kind of pockets or aspects of the poker world that you feel like don't get enough attention or are more interesting than they've gotten credit for?
You know, it's fascinating to me that people aren't more interested in Latin American poker. I spent several years during the beginning of the LAPT down in almost every country that had South American poker. And the stories and the people there are a lot like the EPT was back in 2005 and 2006. You are still getting the older folks who are popular. And the cultures down there are such that, you know, you could easily be sitting in a casino playing a poker tournament and having a massive workers' protest where they're burning tires and burn barrels just outside the casino. Down in Panama, I was fascinated when we went to an LAPT Panama, and they had there were prostitutes everywhere. I mean, more prostitutes than I ever saw in Las Vegas, just outside the poker room waiting. And they literally had a one-in, one-out policy for all the prostitutes that were wanting to stand in line for all the poker players to come out. And I'm not saying that that's...
It was like a cab stand?
Yeah, it's exactly what it was. There were like there was this long escalator at the hotel, and there were prostitutes waiting at the bottom. And when one went out, one came up. And I'm not saying that's a good thing at all, but I am saying it's fascinating to me. And I've been more fascinated in Latin America than I have with almost anything over the last 5-6 years.
I've never been to an LAPD event, and not the prostitute story specifically, but that just everything you just said has made me want to do that.
And the reason you should, I think, and to go beyond the hookers, is that the games are still very loose. They're still very gambly. There's still so much emotion. That's, you know, it's something you don't see necessarily on the EPT or in America. But there's still, like, people are really excited about it. And there's still people who are happy to gamble. And there's, you know, there's all the nationalistic pride that goes along with it. I mean, in Europe, you don't see people getting necessarily as excited that a guy from Denmark won. But if you go down and there's an Argentinian, a Brazilian, a Colombian, and a Panamanian at a table, they're all going to have gigantic screaming rails. And while that may not be everybody's thing, it's still a very emotional game, and it makes it feel like poker used to feel.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually. I was in Prague not like maybe 6 months or so after Martin Stoshko had come second in the main event. And right. I was like talking to a guy on a train who knew nothing at all about poker, but you know, I told him that I played poker. And then he was like, oh, do you know Martin Stoshko? And it was right. Just, like, because he was Czech, you know, it was...
Yeah, I'm headed over to Prague in a couple of weeks, actually. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I've actually never been there for the big... I was just kind of doing a general non-poker Europe trip. But yeah, I've heard it's a very good time and place to play during the whole Prague thing in December, but I've never done it myself.
Yeah, it should be a good time. I think it's going to be a huge festival. I'm getting old, though. I'm not sure if I've got the chops to go out and do one of the big ones anymore.
What goes into it? I mean, when you say don't have the chops, what have you lost?
Well, back when I was 31, 32 years old, working a day that started at 10:30 in the morning and went till 4:30 in the morning was still pretty easy. I was still pretty excited. And, you know, there was at the time, you know, literally like one event to be done. Now, you know, I'm 41 years old. The days last just as long, but there's also 3 or 4 side events going on. There are, you know, not only that, but just, you know, technologically, we're hopping on EPT Live and we're running around trying to get side events results and write 3 or 4 different stories. And it's not just 1 or 2 guys running a thing. There'd be 4 or 5 of us there working. So it's a much bigger undertaking than it used to be. Plus, people expect a lot more. You know, I mean, back 10 years ago, people were happy if they figured out who won a tournament. Today, they're pissed off if they don't know the suits of both cards the guy folded. You know, and so you got there's just a lot more that goes into the work.
What about books? What's lighting your fire on the literature side of things these days?
You know, I of all things right now, I'm reading a book that's from the early 90s. I'm reading David Simon's Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets.
Oh, I love that book.
Yeah, the thing is, I'd never read it. And a Washington Post reporter named Wes Lowry had mentioned it on Twitter. I'm like, that's a book that I've been meaning to read for a long time. And it's literally, I mean, it's keeping me up at nights just because it's so damned good. And that's where my focus is right now. I've spent a lot of time reading a lot more long-form magazine stuff than books over the course of the last year or so. But right now I'm way too deep into David Simon.
And I assume you've seen Homicide as well?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was a show that I grew up watching. I grew up, it was probably the 90s, you know, but, you know, I guess I was in college at the time, you know, and watching Homicide, I'm like, putting the faces on the, you know, names in the book.
Right. It really astonishes me how much, like, because The Wire is such a popular show in the poker world, and yet so few people, even after I tell them, like, go watch Homicide. I mean, it's not as good as The Wire, but, like, it's pretty damn good. I mean, if you like The Wire, you're going to like Homicide. And I just feel like very few people have actually made the effort to seek it out.
Yeah, and I think maybe it's because The Wire is so much more accessible. You know, you can buy the box set and go do it. And Homicide's a little bit harder to seek out. And to be fair, it's not as gritty either. You know, it was a network television program. But damn, it was good. And it came from a damn good book.
So for magazine writing, aside from the obvious, anywhere you would suggest looking?
I read a lot of different people. But I really like a guy named Thomas Lake, who writes long-form stories, often sports-oriented. He's out of Atlanta, and he's a young writer. But in terms of research, like I like to pattern some of how I do my research based on what he does. I read for writers typically more than I do actual publications. Chris Jones, who I mentioned earlier, is another amazing writer. And a guy named Tom Junod, maybe Junod, I can't remember exactly how to pronounce his name, but he also writes for Esquire and wrote a really good long-form piece after 9/11 called The Falling Man. And you should keep up with what he writes, because he's a great American magazine writer right now.
I just Googled Thomas Lake and discovered that he's the one who wrote 2 on 5, which is fantastic. So good call.
The story that he wrote that got me hooked on him was called The Boy They Couldn't Kill, which is about a guy named the son of a football player who had tried to have his wife killed, and the boy lived. And there's actually another guy has written a story about that very same kid recently, but Thomas Lake's piece on it called The Boy They Couldn't Kill is fantastic.
Anything else that you do besides reading to keep your writing chops in shape?
I write as much as I can. I read as much as I can. And I look for good storytelling wherever it is. You know, there are people doing so many different kinds of storytelling now, people are telling stories on Twitter. People are telling stories on Instagram. People are telling stories in music. And I honestly, right now, I spend as much time listening to music or going to see music than I do reading or writing, because I love to play music and I love to listen to music. And there's a guy named Jason Isbell, who's out of Alabama, another Southern boy, who was
writing. Drive-By Truckers, right?
Yeah, he's from the Drive-By Truckers, exactly.
Yeah, we had a big Jason Isbell love fest on Twitter the other day. He's got a new album out.
he's as far as I'm concerned right now, America's best songwriter. And so, you know, he's telling stories in 3 minutes that, you know, it would take people 500 pages in a novel to tell. And so any kind of storytelling that I can find, I look for, and you can find a lot of it in music these days.
Anybody else? So we've now established that you have excellent taste. Who else?
Fantastic! Hey, I win.
Who else should we be listening to?
There's a guy named Sturgill Simpson, who was produced by the same guy that produces Jason Isbell. Sturgill is more of an old country style. He has a voice that sounds a little bit like Waylon Jennings, but he's a psychedelic country star who is very, very good. And probably, of the last couple of years, one of my favorite people to listen to. There's a band called Mandolin Orange out of North Carolina. That it's a female violinist or fiddle player with a mandolin player that puts together some really good, sweet harmonies. Also, if you want to watch something that's really, really cool, and that there's when the Coen brothers put out the Inside Llewyn Davis movie, they did a music show that T-Bone Burnett produced called Another Day, Another Time, where they put everybody who did the music for the movie on stage. And they got them all together to collaborate together. And you've got everybody there from Jack White to Rihanna Giddens from the Carolina Chocolate Drops to the Punch Brothers. And if you don't know the Punch Brothers, find the Punch Brothers. They're led by Chris Thiele, who used to play with the band Nickel Creek, but he's a mandolin virtuoso. Anyway, put all of these people together backstage and together to play this music, and they collaborated for this hour and a half, 2 hour long stage show that eventually ended up on Showtime, but you can now watch most of it online. Just absolutely wonderful, wonderful songwriting, beautiful music. Just the folk ways of music explode out of that. Those are a few good ones. There's a duo called the Milk Carton Kids that sound a little bit like Simon and Garfunkel, but they're absolutely hilarious, and their stage banter is wonderful. But they do beautiful little two-part harmony and two-part guitar playing. I could go on and on. So,
well, I mean, if I'll let you take a breather, and do you mind if I throw in a recommendation for Ha Ha Tonka in sort of roughly in the country tradition?
I know Ha Ha Tonka. They've been around for a long time. I did college radio before I got into TV, and I remember Ha Ha Tonka. So it's been a while since I've listened to them, actually, but it's a name I know.
Yeah. They have some very good albums. And they're still making music, and to my ear, at least, good music. And some of it's definitely well told stories in 3 minutes, that sort of thing.
That's fantastic.
Well, thanks for getting nostalgic with us and giving us all those great recommendations, and for taking some time to come on the show. We really appreciate it.
Well, guys, congratulations on your 150th. I'm impressed that you made it this far. Not many people could stick with it, and you guys have had some really, just really good guests that have been fun to listen to, especially, you know, Brian Koppelman. That was a fantastic episode, and you guys should be really, really proud of it. So be proud that you're 150 deep, and I hope you keep going.
Well, thanks very much. Exactly. Now we have one more really good guest. So.
Well, thank you, guys.
Take care.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you.